Log into Zoom. It's like default name. All right, welcome, brothers. I am thrilled to have you all here for another edition of Friday with Fridays. This is the first time that we've had an actual presentation since I believe May at this point. So thank you and welcome. So during the meeting, if you would like to communicate while Brother Akampora is sharing his screen, please feel free to have your chat window open and I will have my chat open and active. So if there are comments or questions during the presentation, I can relay those to our presenter. So speaking of our presenter, I would like to introduce Brother Jonathan Akampora. I got to meet Brother Akampora when we were sitting next to each other during the 2018 National Convention as Province Governor of Province 1 and, excuse me, Province Governor of I'm coming to take over all of them, Governor of Province 2 and CPR of Province 1. So Jonathan is a 2014 initiate of the Zeta Omega chapter of Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia. He enjoys middle school English, or excuse me, he teaches middle school English in New York City, but also acknowledges the existence of Chicago-style pizza. Jonathan studied oboe performance and English literature at the Hart School in University of Hartford, holds a master's in English education from Teachers College, Columbia University, and is a current Juris Doctorate student at Seton Hall Law School. The title of his presentation is A Brief History of Pizza in the United States, War, Whiteness, and Why You Should Care About Cheese on Bread. Brothers, it is my privilege to introduce to you Brother Jonathan Akampora.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Guys, thank you all for coming. It's actually really nice that I'm talking about pizza because, as Dave mentioned, I just started law school. And so this is the only thing I've gotten to read or write about in the last 4 weeks that hasn't involved like a horrible accident and then me trying to determine who's liable and why. So really, this was just like far more cheerful, even though parts of this presentation are not cheerful. So I became really interested in pizza when I was in graduate school. And I became really interested in the idea of literacy practices and food as communication. And I think we saw a little bit of that tonight, actually. And so there's sort of like two things that I want to kind of just posit up front. And if you just sort of take them and hold on to them and just sort of like think about them as we go through the presentation and just like assume they're true for now, we can kind of like work within that space. So the first is that food is speech. Every time we eat something, every time we engage in the act of eating in something within a community, we are making some kind of speech act. And the second is that all speech is political. And I think we saw a little bit of that tonight. My roommate, Isaac from Buffalo, jumped in to say that soda is properly called pop. We both live in New York and disagree on that, but we are from different parts of New York. I also hear people calling it Coke. All soda is Coke. Texan brother referring to to Dr. Pepper, right? And this is one country and we're talking about a carbonated beverage. What does it mean to consume something? What are you saying when you consume something, right? And then the idea of also all speech being political. At some level, you're always, you know, you're performing an identity within a space. You're always asserting a certain kind of identity. And if you were, for instance, to walk into a New York City restaurant and order a pop, what kind of identity are you performing? What are you saying about who you are, where you're from, maybe what some of your values are, right or wrong, right? What are you communicating to that other person when you order a pop? And I think for me, pizza embodies that in New York City, like nothing else. Pizza sometimes referred to, particularly in New York, as the great equalizer. I don't know if I entirely believe that, but you can very easily walk into a New York City pizza place and you will see a guy in a suit, a guy in a construction uniform, people come in, order pizza in 4-5 different languages. And so all of that is happening and everyone is eating the same thing, doing the same thing in a city where people of drastically different backgrounds do not live in the same places, do not go to the same schools. Other than this, do not largely eat the same food and do not speak the same language. New York City is the most diverse. I'm going to get to my favorite pizza at the end. There's a completely non-opinionated, entirely fact-based official list of recommendations. So I'll save that for the end. It's all opinions, everything, nothing matters. Where was I talking about? Oh, right, identity. And so that in New York City, it's kind of that like one thing that almost everyone kind of just seems on board with. And so I think for me, this really became clear. I'm going to show a very brief clip of John Stewart just to kind of talk us into this. John Stewart is somewhat well known for doing several pizza rants. This is a short excerpt from one where Sarah Palin, this is prior to Donald Trump running for president. This has got to be right after 2012, 2013, maybe. Sarah Palin, I think, had just run for vice president and lost, so probably 2013. And she's visiting New York City, and she meets up with Donald Trump, who decides to take her out for pizza, right? A real New York City experience. He takes her to Famous Familia, which is an Albanian pizza chain. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. It is perfectly edible. You can find it in nearly every train station and airport. And Donald Trump takes two slices of pizza, stacks them on top of each other, and eats them with a fork and knife. Donald Trump is from Queens. And I think the feeling among most New Yorkers was he should know better. And so for me, that sort of really, really is emblematic of this idea of what is he communicating? Why, like, what about his act of eating pizza is communicating the fact that he is out of touch with like regular New Yorkers? And so here's just a brief clip of, yes, allow it to share my screen. You know, it really wouldn't be a Zoom presentation if we weren't having some technical difficulties.
Sounds like somebody's on an Apple.
Oh, click the lock to make changes. Yep, I'm using a new computer for this, which was my mistake. Zoom will not be able to record the contents of your screen until it is quit. All right, I'm going to quit and reopen Zoom, and I will be back in about 30 seconds.
Okie dokie. We'll see you then.
Rookie mistake, using new hardware without testing it.
I was going to invite him to try sharing his screen while we were in the intro. And now I realize that should have happened.
It should have.
And life goes on.
Yep.
And we just need this video to happen because the Alaskans in the room are still cringing to see the Sarah Palin.
I thought there might be a little bit of a reaction there.
Yeah.
She is the best thing ever to come out of that state.
For comedy purposes, yes. And we came here because of her, but that's a convoluted long story.
But she's such a wonderful person.
There we go. All right.
All right, we're back. Can everyone see a picture of Jon Stewart looking absolutely enraged over
his life? We can. Yes, indeed.
And this is him showing you the proper way to consume a slice of pizza in New York City.
God's sakes. Fuck. Can learn. You fold it, you eat it. One hand. You got the other hand free. A little Parmesan, a little oregano, a little red pepper. Maybe you point at your friend and go, look at that. Is that? Now you don't want me to go, you take care of that thing? Is that? All right, very nice. Or maybe you just use your other hand to take an irresponsible amount of napkins. And maybe a few minutes later, you just throw them the
And so here you see him, you hold it in one hand, it comes on these paper plates, you have these napkins, you can't quite get them out of the dispenser, you take too many. If you order a slice of pizza in New York City, that is what it is supposed to feel like. And that is, right, you see other people you know there, you hold it in one hand. This is all like understood, like if you live here, this is how you eat a slice of pizza. And Donald Trump has completely failed to do that. Right? What is he communicating to people in this moment with his speech? Food is speech. Speech is political. We can't agree on hamburgers. We can't agree on what to call soda. We can't agree on the right way to eat pizza. And when we don't, there are sometimes consequences. So with that, I'm going to sort of, I just wanted to sort of preface that as we go in, that food is speech and speech is political. And so we're going to jump in to the main presentation, which I have here, and which, if my computer feels like it, it's totally going to bring up on the screen, and it's not going to give me an issue this time. All right, slideshow. Okay, can everyone see the slideshow? Like it's actually in present mode? All right, Zoom. So brief history of pizza in the United States, war, whiteness, and why you should care about cheese on bread. So I think it's really important to sort of start with, yes, this is about pizza in America, but to consider how it got to America in the first place. So where and when was pizza invented? So pizza comes to us today from the area of Italy formerly known as the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. I'm talking about southern Italy here. And so prior to Italian unification in 1861, we're really talking about a series of countries and city-states. I have a map right here. So this is showing us what it looked like in 1829. And I'm talking about, if you can see my mouse, this area down here, Naples in particular. And if you watch the screen, essentially what you're watching here is the unification of Italy largely involves, as you watch, essentially Piedmont up here, slowly conquering the rest of the island, the rest of the peninsula, the Papal States being last. And what you have in Italy in 1861, and this is still true in Italy today, is largely similar to what you had in the United States in 1861, which is a pretty economically robust, very urban north and a rural poor south. And you can see everything is slowly getting added to this new country of Italy. So this is really important. So after the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 AD and until 1861, there is no such thing as the Kingdom of Italy. There is no Italy. It is a bunch of different places. If you live in Naples, you are in the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. For a couple hundred years, you've been ruled by the Bourbons from France. There is no sense of Italy. There is no sense of like, I am Italian. That just isn't really an identity that would have existed. To the point that the languages these people are speaking are not mutually intelligible. After the unification of Italy, they sort of just picked one language kind of in the middle and ran with it. And they're like, everyone speaks this now. But it's still to the point that if you grow up in Sicily, you learn to speak Italian because they teach it to you in school. It is not really quite the same language. Let me just briefly check. Yes, I am Italia. All right. And so I'm going to click on to, we're going to talk about essentially the different parts of pizza. I want to start with tomatoes because I think tomatoes more than anything else really exemplify the fact that this is truly an Italian-American food. Tomatoes are a food of the New World. So prior to the Columbian Exchange, they're not showing up in Italy. They become very popular in Italy for two reasons. The first is that I mentioned that that former Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, at this point still the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, is very poor and very rural. Most of the of continental Europe is avoiding tomatoes because they think they are poisonous. Rural Naples did not think they were poisonous. They were fine eating nightshades. There really was a massive food shortage for hundreds of years, and the tomatoes grew really well, and they turned out particularly sweet due to the volcanic soil around Naples. So Naples is like right in kind of like in the shadow of Mount Vesuvius near Pompeii. So the tomatoes grow really well. The people are largely, I'm going to use the words poor and uneducated. So no one, they're not reading books saying like, oh, these are nightshades, don't eat them. There's food. It tastes great. People are going with it. So tomatoes were first recorded in Italy in 1544 and were cultivated as early as the 1600s. They were not particularly popular in southern Italy until the 1700s. And that's sort of about when they start to get added to some pizzas. At the same time, people have been eating flatbreads in Naples and Sicily for hundreds of years. And they were popular both among poor urban workers in places like Naples and rural peasants in some of like the surrounding areas continuing south from Naples. So the cheapness of the ingredients and the variety of flavors you can get made it particularly popular. So it's not that hard or expensive to make bread. You can add, say, like a little bit of salt or maybe some basil, right? And you still have not significantly run up the cost of what you're eating. But with a little bit of salt or a little bit of a different fat or a little bit of a different spice, it sort of feels like maybe you're eating a different food. Food in Italy has long been associated with wealth. It's a particularly kind of fraught thing in Italy to this day. And we're going to touch on that just a little bit later. So early Neapolitan pizza is pretty similar to white pizza now. So it's essentially a flatbread. A flatbread covered in garlic, lard, and salt. Garlic, especially, historically a food of the poor, particularly in Italy. So to this day, if you were to go to like a nice restaurant in, say, Milan, there's not a lot of garlic used, and fancy Italian chefs will criticize American chefs for the liberal use of garlic in Italian-American cooking. It is considered a poor person's spice. And food in Italy is particularly tied to class. And there's something historically like shameful about not being able to provide for one's family, having to flavor one's food with garlic, not eating meat at every meal. And that still pervades Italian food culture today at some level. The early cheese used, and this was more expensive and rare. This was not like an everyday kind of food. So the flatbreads I mentioned, which were just essentially like lard, salt, basil, that's like actually a very typical breakfast food. These were more of like a special occasion. These you would eat on a weekend. They would use caciocavallo, which is a hard cheese, then made from horse's milk, now more commonly made from cow's or buffalo's milk. Just check the chat for questions. Okay. And this was an unpopular peasant food. Like, I really cannot emphasize this enough. This is what you eat if you live in the 19th century in Naples and you do not have a lot of money. And it's not really eaten anywhere north of Naples. Samuel Morse, the telegraph guy, while taking a tour through Italy, described it as a species of most nauseating cake covered over with slices of pomodoro or tomatoes and sprinkled with little fish and black pepper and I know not what other ingredients. It altogether looks like a piece of bread that has been taken reeking out of the sewer. Other Italians thought it was gross. A popular food publication of the time described it as the appearance of complicated filth that matches the dirt of the vendor. And so here again, we sort of see linking the people selling the food with the food itself. And a Neapolitan businessman opened a pizzeria in Rome in the mid 19th century, and it failed miserably. The Romans did not want to eat peasant food from Naples. After the unification of Italy in 1861, Italians started leaving Italy, particularly Southern Italy. They moved largely to the United States and Argentina. And this migration between 1861 and 1920 represents the largest voluntary migration in human history. So at no other point in human history have more people willingly moved from one place to another. By 1920, more than 4 million Italians had come to the United States. And between 30 and 50% of them would return to Italy. Why leave? There's political strife, widespread poverty, particularly in the rural South. And what's different about this particular group of Italian immigrants is there had been a steady trickle, if you will, of Italian immigration into the United States from the beginning, but it was largely skilled artisans from the North, often people coming to go sell things like mirrors, for instance, to the continental United States. This new group of immigrants was largely poor and uneducated. These are people from the rural South. The literacy rate in the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies in 1861 was, depending on which source you check, somewhere between 14 and 20%. So really, one out of every five people can read, if that. So this is not, you know, skilled artisans coming over, look at my craft. This is kind of people fleeing political strife and poverty. And like all immigrant groups, Italian immigrants brought with them food and culture. Italians largely settled in cities in the Northeast, namely New York, Boston, New Haven, and Trenton, New Jersey, which for any like pizza super fans out here, you notice all of these have their own distinctive style of pizza, which we will get to. Pizza really kicks off during World War II. So there's a large, There is a large movement. So a large number of Italians were of both Italian Americans fighting in the war for the United States and just American soldiers at large were stationed in Southern Europe, taking over Sicily, moving north, trying to kick out Mussolini. Italian immigrants, despite the fact that we were at war with Italy, were not treated the same way, for instance, Japanese immigrants were during World War II. There were no internment camps of Italian Americans in the United States. Rather, they were valued in the United States Army as translators. There you go. That said, the United States soldiers head over to Southern Italy and they like the food, right? They're eating, they try pizza there in Southern Italy, many of them for the first time. So prior to World War II in the United States, people are not eating pizza. It is considered like in kind of like an ethnic curiosity, something you might try if you happen to be on say Mulberry Street in Little Italy, but this is not something that most people are eating. Chicago deep dish has not been invented at this point. I believe the first pizza place is Lombardi's in New York City, and I'd have to double check. I think the year on it is 1908. But again, this is the kind of thing that recent immigrants are eating. This has not hit the mainstream. So if, for instance, you are an Irish American living in New York City at the time, you've probably never tried pizza. If you are descended from German immigrants who arrived in the 1700s and your family has been living in New York City for 150 years, you have not tried pizza. Like pretty much guaranteed, it is something eaten largely in Little Italy, Arthur Avenue up in the Bronx, parts of Queens, but this is not something being eaten by most Americans until the end of World War II. So soldiers returned to the United States and began eating pizza with enthusiasm. American troops returning home from the war were excited about the Southern Italian dishes they had tried. Essentially, pizza explodes in popularity in the United States before it becomes popular in Italy. So American soldiers invade Italy during World War II, try the food of the rural South, realize that that food of the rural South is being served in Northeast cities when they arrive back home and generate more demand for it. It blows up in Italy following that. All right, I see a few questions in the chat. So I'm just going to, okay. And that's Dave Friday, a great host telling me to stop checking the chat. Thank you, Dave. And he'll let me know. American tourists traveled to Italy post-World War II and demanded pizza. They had heard that there was good food in Southern Italy and they would like it. And American tourists, are not exactly known for being super tactful or culturally aware. This is true now, this was true then. The average American tourist does not know and did not know that Milan and Naples are culturally about as far apart as you could possibly get. So they hear there is pizza in Italy, they have tried this Italian food in New York, all right? And in 1952, they go to Italy and they would like to try the pizza from Italy. And they do not understand why Milan does not have it. Milan, of course, does not have it because that is poor food from Southerners who don't speak Italian right, according to them, right? That's from a different country. Why would we make that? That's peasant food. We don't eat that here in the fancy North. So there's a little bit of a kind of cultural resentment of pizza throughout much of the late 20th century in Italy. which does change starting in the 90s, frankly. But really, pizza came to most of Italy from the United States. As this is happening, post-World War II, I want to talk briefly about sort of an expanding definition of whiteness. I'm sure this is not news to people, but the definition of who is and is not white has changed pretty dramatically over the last 100 years. And so kind of another theoretical concept is that whiteness does not necessarily exist. It is sort of a concept that we have invented that stands in opposition to something else, generally in opposition to another, in opposition to blackness. So for most of the 20th century, Italians were not considered white, to the point that if you look at, for instance, my great-grandfather comes over on a boat from Italy, his skin complexion is listed as dark. We're not that dark. We're just not. Like my family, like I'm not terribly, you know, I have a pretty light complexion, as does everyone else in my family. But Italian Americans coming, coming over from Southern Italy were labeled as not white from the moment they arrived. It's a social construct. Italians were not allowed to own property in certain places, were not allowed to work certain jobs. This is also true, for instance, of Irish immigrants, certainly true of Jewish immigrants, and most certainly true of a number of groups today that are, of course, still not considered white. I bring this up to point out that whiteness is a social construct. It has not always meant the same thing. I'm Italian. If you were to ask me if I'm white, the answer is like, yes, obviously. But historically, that has not always been true. I hate to even use this as an example, but Governor Cuomo, the former, it's very exciting, former Governor Cuomo, his father, Mario Cuomo, was governor. When Mario Cuomo graduated law school, he entered politics in part because absolutely no one would hire him. He graduated first in his class from law school, but no law firms would hire an Italian. That had to be the 1950s in New York. This right here is the storming of a New Orleans jail in 1891 during a lynching of 11 Italian Americans. New Orleans has had a particularly large Sicilian population, to the point that there was a section of New Orleans called Little Palermo. I bring this up because I know a lot of people were at National Convention, and I was surprised when I got to New Orleans that there was so much Italian food there, because I've always thought of New Orleans as like kind of a French city. And yet I found like all of this Italian food everywhere. And I was like, where is this all coming from? It comes from a particularly large Sicilian community from the late 1800s that had moved into New Orleans. Sicilians in particular were demonized in the American press, among other places, as being less than human. Sicilians were believed to be genetically inferior to other Europeans. They were considered, this all comes out of the eugenics movement, but genetically prone to criminality. And this sort of thing was being published in like the New York Times, which has since issued apologies, by the way. There's an excellent article for anyone interested in the Times and their history of racism against Italian Americans. Great article called How Italians Became White. I do recommend, if you're like looking for some more reading, I took this picture right out of that article, and it's particularly interesting. Essentially, Italians were accused of killing like a local notable figure. I just wanted to show you that here you see people storming the city jail and killing, lynching 11 Italians in the city of New Orleans.
Real quick, could you tell me the name of the article one more time, please?
Sure. It's called How Italians Became White.
How Italians Became White. I'm going to put that into the chat. There's also a question, you may be addressing this later on, but is there a New Orleans style pizza based on what you just told us?
Not that I know of, but it does not mean they're not. Because I went in and I was pretty determined to try all the gumbo I could, but there's a chance I missed out. I want to talk briefly about Columbus Day. I think a lot of liberals in particular really struggle, in New York at least, with Columbus Day. Here's my hot take. Columbus was a bad dude. He cut people's hands off and we should not celebrate him. You know, like he was a bad guy. Other people at the time thought he was a bad guy. And so I think a lot of people, particularly in New York, are surprised we can't get rid of Columbus Day. Columbus Day started in the United States. Following that lynching in New Orleans, President Benjamin Harrison declared Columbus Day in part because Italy had cut diplomatic ties with the United States. So think about it. If you're Italy, these are technically still your citizens. Between 30 and 50% of them are coming back, right? These are your people. They're coming to the United States and they're being murdered in mob violence in the streets. Benjamin Harrison obviously does not want this, nor does he want a major political problem in Europe. And so they declare Columbus Day. And the reason they declare Columbus Day was that Columbus, an Italian sailor who was shore sailing for Spain, but of Italian origin, right? If he discovered America, that kind of makes him the first American, doesn't it? There's nothing more, you know, more American than the guy that discovered it, right? He helped found the country, which firmly puts Italian Americans sort of in the founding of the country. This is a move sort of designed to say, hey, American mainstream, white people, look, they're one of you. Now, there's a few things about this that don't hold up. The first is that Columbus was not from Italy, because Italy did not exist until 1861. Columbus sailed in 1492. So we're only off by a couple hundred years. The second is that Columbus is from Genoa, I believe, like about as far north as you can get. The joke in that part of Italy is that everyone who lives there is actually German. Like if you were to go to Rome, they'll joke and they'll be like, oh, those guys, they're German. There are parts of Italy over there where they actually, you can speak German and people will understand what you're saying. Not because the language is similar, but because it's on the border and everyone's like, yeah, all right. That part of Italy has absolutely nothing to do with where all of these immigrants are coming from. But it's sort of those lies we tell ourselves as nations in order to sort of exist. After the unification of Italy, Garibaldi, who was sort of like their like George Washington figure, the guy who went around on a horse, he's got a sword, he conquered half of Italy, right? Afterwards, he commented, we've made Italy, now we have to make Italians. There's got to be some kind of national myth that everyone buys into. And so there's us, and then there's them. And first, you've got to create the us. And when you're creating the us, it's very helpful to also create a them. And this continues today. I got an email last week about a scholarship opportunity for Italian American law students with Columbus in the name. I did not apply for it, not because of that, largely because I wasn't technically eligible. I will take their money. But again, this is a group that was sort of founded about 100 years ago to help the fact that, again, you know, Mario Cuomo graduates law school, no one hires him. So this is a group that was set up to help, like, you know, professional Italian Americans sort of achieve some kind of mainstream success in a job market that was not hiring them. The New York City Columbus Day Parade remains deeply controversial and difficult. Even when the state and the city were run by Andrew Cuomo, the Italian American governor, and Bill de Blasio, the Italian American mayor, both of whom are Democrats. It's just kind of a complicated issue. In a particularly Italian place. I can be argued that pizza has done much of the work of including Italian Americans within this expanding imaginary concept of whiteness. So as pizza has become more and more popular, discrimination against Italian Americans has almost entirely disappeared. Pizza is not the sole cause of this. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that lynchings of Italian Americans stopped, because it turns out that if you put like a little bit of Parmesan cheese and maybe some chicken on pizza, it slaps. Like, I'm not gonna tell you that. I am gonna tell you that there is something to be said for being credited with originating the most popular food in the country. Pizza moved from being an ethnic curiosity to post-World War II, being part of a typical mainstream, like white American life. After World War II, ordering a pizza was something you did with like your family. Like pizza night is part of now the mainstream American culture, rather than being something you had to take a train into a part of town where no one spoke English in order to buy. That's just a very different kind of thing. I'm gonna change slides here. Just some fun facts about pizza. Since the 1960s, the price of a slice of pizza has almost perfectly matched the price of a New York City subway ride. If anyone's curious, the current cost of a New York City subway swipe is $2.75. I think the pizza price has started to go up a little bit, but that's mostly because they were supposed to raise the subway costs this year and didn't because of the pandemic. This has also changed a little bit since 2008 and the dollar slices, and we'll talk about that a little more in a little bit. And then here at the end, the following is a list of completely accurate, inarguable list of the best pizza available in New York City and New Haven, Connecticut, along with some comments and critiques of famous places. Okay, if you are to go to New York City and order pizza, I recommend avoiding anywhere that is like a sit-down restaurant. This is street food. Get it? Get a slice. There are some like sit-down places that do, and we'll talk about like Grimaldi's in a minute and Giuliana's, but I recommend just going, spending about $2.75 and getting a slice. I think the best slice of pizza in New York City is at a place called Joe's Pizza. It's very good. I really cannot recommend it enough. I also recommend Bleecker Street Pizza. Both of them are great. Both of them are located in the West Village. Bleecker Street Pizza has the advantage of being located directly across the street from Marie's Crisis, which is a musical theater gay bar. So, you know, this is a group of Sinfonians. We like music and gay bars. So if you're in New York City, I recommend visit Marie's Crisis. It's a musical sing-along. Grab a great slice of $3 pizza across the street. Really hard to go wrong. Next, if you're taking the train in, which I recommend, why not? Stop global warming. There are three pizza places within Penn Station. There are two called Roses. There is one that's much better than Roses. Don't go to Roses. But if you leave Penn Station and walk one block north and one block east, you can go to New York Pizza Suprema, which is really excellent. And again, I would just draw your attention to the sort of this idea of culture. And it says Italian owned since 1964. Do with that what you will. Is that problematic that they have to put that on the sign? I don't know. But yeah, it's a classic slice near Penn Station. Really hard to go wrong. For the more adventurous, if you have a car, best Sicilian slice. When I'm talking about a Sicilian slice, I'm talking about a square slice. It's usually about an inch thick. They bake it in trays. The best Sicilian slice can be found at VI Pizza. It's a bit of a hike. It is in Bayside, Queens. It is totally worth the drive. It is a hole in the wall in Bayside, Queens that has been open for at least 60 years. It's very good. What about dollar slices? Just don't. That is my official advice to you. Spend $2.75 and get something bigger that tastes good. That's it. The dollar slices were an invention of 2008. They really started to pop up during the recession. And the problem is that then they sort of like made good slices and just made them like smaller. And the idea was that it was like they were working on volume and the slices were a little smaller. They're still a dollar and it's not 2008 anymore. And inflation is a thing. So if in 2021, you're still selling pizza for a dollar a slice, it's because you've made your ingredients worse. It just straight up is not profitable. The rent has gone up. The cost of the ingredients has gone up. The price has not changed. They are truly trash at this point. Just don't. Okay, let me see where my mouse went. Okay, New Haven Pizza. So for those of you visiting Connecticut, New Haven, there's all these, I get asked about this a lot. New Haven has like, the best pizza in the world. People will come out with like an article and they'll be like, you all think New York City has the best pizza in the world, but what about New Haven? There's three pizza places in New Haven that have been open for since the 1920s. The best, it's Modern Pizza, Frank Pepe's, or Sally's a Pizza. go to Frank or Sally's. They're both good. If you go to Frank Pepe's, they do like a clam pizza that I've never tried, but it's supposed to be like something else. It's like a white garlic clam thing. I recommend Sally's a pizza. It is called a pizza. It's based on like a particular Neapolitan dialect that was very pop, like really spoken among Italian immigrants in New Haven in like the 1920s. Sally's is very good. Note that the New Haven style requires like charring the pizza, so your hands will get covered in like burnt stuff, but it is worth eating. I would not go to Connecticut just to get the pizza. Okay. Okay, I see a lot of things in Alfredo's Pizza versus Pizza by Alfredo. Okay, I'll talk about the, okay, so someone says, isn't there more than one Joe's Pizza and the whole thing goes with that? So yes and no. So you're thinking of Famous Ray's? So there's Famous Ray's Original, Original Famous Ray's Original Ray's Famous Ray. I don't know. They're all okay. The original one has been out of business for about 15 years. Joe's Pizza, which has been open for about 100 years or so, maybe a little less. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Joe's has been open since the 60s or 70s. But they've recently opened in the last like 2 years, two or three more locations, all of which are pretty good. Like, they have one in Times Square now. The line is around the block, but it's excellent. Let's see. You might be thinking of like a margarita pizza. The place to do that is Brooklyn. There are two places to get a margarita pizza in Brooklyn that are great. The first is called Grimaldi's. Grimaldi's was open for about 100 years, family restaurant. The guy running Grimaldi's, like the last one, the dude's like 80 something at this point, decided to retire and sell the business. He sold Grimaldi's. It's still great. I was there probably a couple weeks before the pandemic set in. He decided he did not want to retire. And he instead took the same recipe and opened three doors down from his old restaurant, named it after his mother. And so Grimaldi's Pizza, the original one, is really now Giuliana's Pizza. They're both fine. It's the same exact slice. Go to whichever one has a shorter line because you can wait up to an hour for a table, but it really is something else. And that's what I got. So that's everything I have about pizza. I mentioned before, there's an academic version and a less academic version of this. I didn't want to like bore you by being like, I got this information from here. So if you're interested in learning more, University of Chicago Press, a couple of years back, Pizza, A Global History is good if incomplete. For more about like food and culture, there's a project from a professor at St. John's University in Queens called Taco Literacy. And he talks a lot about culture and foodways and communication. And if you're interested in that whole realm, I recommend checking out Taco Literacy. I also think it's particularly interesting because tacos have become more and more popular in recent years. And yet we have not really seen a decrease in Hispanic and Latino racism. And so that's just sort of like an interesting thing to sort of think about is, you know, what happens with pizza over time. Oh, what about Chicago lasagna pizza? Okay, so depending upon who you ask, Chicago-style deep dish was founded by one of two people, either a man from Texas named Ike Sewell or his Italian chef. I don't know what to believe. It was either founded in 1943 or 1954, depending upon who you ask. There are no written records. The city of Chicago has hired people to figure this out, and they have not. What I can tell you was that it was, if not invented, certainly popularized by Pizzeria Uno. The idea of putting like closing it off came probably in the 80s when they started putting like a layer of dough on top of that and turning it into like a real casserole situation. It's nothing like New York pizza, but I mean, it's pretty good. I do not have specific Chicago pizza recommendations because I lived in the state of Illinois. That's my roommate setting off the fire alarm. I lived in the state of Illinois for like 6 months, which is not enough time to like, so if anyone has any Chicago pizza recommendations, I'm like totally here for them, but I don't know enough to comment.
Lou Malnati's.
So I did have one, perhaps question, perhaps comment. I remember seeing a special on pizza a number of years ago. And one of the things that they talked about was the ability of factory workers to pick up a fresh pizza in the morning on their way into work, have a slice or two for breakfast, and then place it on, you know, a heater that was in their factory to make sure that they had a nice warm lunch as well. My mind is telling me that this was in the post-World War I era. Does that timeline make sense in terms of your presentation?
In New York City?
In New York City.
That would totally make sense. So Italian immigration was really stemmed off in 1920. At the same time, like a lot of Italian immigrants are living in tenement houses and working in low-wage factory jobs, and they are the only ones eating pizza. So yeah, that would probably make a lot of sense, really, from like the 1920 right on to the post-World War II economic and pizza boom.
Dave, that sounds connected to the Cornish pasty thing. Oh yeah, Keith's saying the same thing, the British meat pies, that you could have food that you'd eat while you're doing filthy work and then throw away the crust.
Yeah, there you go.
Were you watching the Great British Bake Off when they were talking about that?
Well, we have those in Michigan. We do pasties around here.
I think the calzone was designed to be a pizza that was easier to eat by hand, which I think it's really failed in that regard. And that I feel like an actual slice of pizza is way easier to eat than a calzone.
I guess it depends on your intent with what to do with like the outer crust of it afterward. But I agree. I think pizza by the slice, especially the way that John Stewart demonstrated during his little segment, you fold it in half to make sure you have the structural integrity, and then you can one hand that and throw napkins or wave at your friends with your other hand.
Quick note, when do you want to stop the recording?
Well, I was going to do one quick outro and say thank you very much to Brother Akampora for the presentation.
Thank you for having me and letting me talk about pizza for a half hour.
That was fantastic.
More than a half
hour. Absolutely wonderful. Were there any other questions or comments about the presentation?
No.
Well, seeing none, we'll give you one more thank you for the presentation. That was great. And Brother Angel, I think we're good.